Yeah.
Hey, it's great to have you here. This is
thank you.
It's a wonderful book. You know, occasionally you find a book that is hard to put down, and I think that's probably the best compliment that a reader can give to an author.
I tried to write a book so big it would be hard to pick up.
Well, it is a big book, but the interesting thing about it is it's so compartmentalized. There are so many different elements to the life of your character, and that wonderful portrait of that West Virginia farm family, that it could almost be split up into little stories and vignettes, in fact. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it all comes together quite nicely.
I hope so, yeah.
And, of course, you fill in the parts. We learn more and more about your character as time goes on. So let's talk a little bit about the book and a little bit about you. I believe I saw in some of the publicity material that a lot of the book is semi-autobiographical, which certainly is not surprising. But tell me how this book came about.
Well, it began maybe 10 years ago as just a germ of an idea, just a note in my notebooks. I think I had the notion then of writing a very ambitious saga of an American rural family. Originally, I had in mind writing about several generations of the same family over a period of a century or more, beginning back with the Civil War. It was going to be about a 1,000-page novel, at least. I had a great title for it. I was going to call it Peace and War. But gradually, over the years, the ambition got trimmed down quite a bit, and it ended up being the story mainly of two brothers and their families.
Thank goodness it didn't turn out to be as long. I don't dislike generational novels. They do tend to be quite long. Tell me about yourself. When you grew up, it was in Pennsylvania. What town was it in Pennsylvania?
I was born and raised on a farm near a village called Home, H-O-M-E, population about 125, counting dogs and chickens. And now, 60 years later, it's still about the same.
Mm.
My parents still live there, they're still alive, and still active physically and mentally.
Where is Home?
60 miles east of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the Allegheny Mountains. Sort of hillbilly country, coal mining, marginal farming, economists call a depressed area. Mm. I think it always was and always will be.
Not far from West Virginia.
Pretty close to the West Virginia border.
Mm-hmm. What did your family do as you grew up? They were farmers, obviously. But
yes, basically they both came from farm families. My father is what I call a side hill farmer, or submarginal farmer. He managed to support his family by farming, logging, coal mining, school bus driving, anything he could get.
Does he bear resemblance to the father in the book?
To some extent, but I would like to state sooner or later in this interview that it is not an autobiographical novel. As I've told other people, it's maybe 12% autobiographical and 88% fictional.
Mm-hmm.
I use my own life as a framework for the novel, geographically and chronologically. The career of Henry Lightcap, the central figure of this novel, follows mine. But I think as a person, as a personality, as a character, he's quite different from me.
Mm-hmm.
Hope so, certainly. Mm-hmm.
As you grew up in this farming area of Pennsylvania, was there some inkling that at some point in your life you would be a writer?
I was a scorekeeper for the local baseball team, and that led to some pretty creative work.
Yeah.
And I was also on the team and always trying to get my batting average up. I think the desire to do something creative entered my soul in my high school years. But I didn't know what I wanted to do, whether it be an artist or a writer or a journalist, professor of philosophy. All of those various ambitions went through my head in those days.
That's not unusual.
I flunked journalism in high school twice.
How?
It's difficult, yeah.
I thought people took journalism because that was the easiest thing to do.
I had a hard time getting the facts straight. Maybe that's when I decided I would be a creative writer.
Well, there's a lot of
I'd be assigned to cover a basketball game, and I forget to get the score.
There's a lot of difference between creative writing and journalism, that's for sure. Some people think it's very much the same. I've talked to a lot of people. They've gone off to college to study journalism because they wanted to be, quote, a writer. But
well, I've done a lot of what I like to call creative or literary journalism also. Half of the books I've had published are collections of essays, nonfiction, dealing with all sorts of subjects. Yes, I've often thought I might enjoy writing a weekly column, something I might try sometime.
You went to the University of New Mexico, then.
That's right.
How did you find your way there?
When I was a kid of 17, I hitchhiked around the country, discovered the American West, fell in love with it instantly, and I resolved then and there that as soon as I could, which meant as soon as I got out of the Army, I was in the tail end of World War II, that I would go back to the West. I came back from Italy, sent off letters of application to every school in the West, and New Mexico just happened to be the first to respond, where I might have gone to Oregon or Montana or somewhere in California.
Why did you like, or why do you like the West so much?
Oh, I suppose it's the wide open landscape, and the strange history, and the great variety of people, and the great diversity of landscape from below sea level valleys like Death Valley to 14,000 foot peaks and everything in between. And the general spaciousness, the great sense of space that always gave me a feeling of exhilaration. I enjoyed being able to see for 100 miles. And, well, whatever it is, it certainly appealed to my soul.
What
instantly, as I said, love at first sight. And I've lived in the Southwest ever since 1947, with the exception of a year in Europe and a year here in the New York area.
What happened after college?
I had academic ambitions at one time. Thought I would try to get a Ph.D. in philosophy and become a professor. But then I discovered that I could make a living by working 5 or 6 months a year as a seasonal ranger for the National Park Service. And so I did that for the next 15 or 16 years. The great beauty of that for me was that it gave me plenty of leisure time, lots of freedom. I would work 5 or 6 months a year and manage to save enough money to get through the winters. And by that time, I wanted to be a writer. And I think anyone who is serious about writing should try to find part-time work, seasonal work, or, as Thoreau recommended, refuse to work more than 6 weeks a year. I compromised and worked 6 months a year, which is ideal for somebody who wanted to do what I wanted to do.
And that's such a compromise, though, when you think about it.
Yeah, I had to make that kind of sacrifice, although it didn't even occur to me at the time that it was a sacrifice. I enjoyed it. Yeah. I lived at or below the official poverty line and didn't even know it. I cared less if I had known it.
Tell me about your first published book. How'd that come about?
That was a very bad novel called Jonathan Troy, published way back in 1954 by Dodd Mead here in New York. I entered it in a contest sponsored by Dodd Mead. I think they gave me second or third prize and asked me to finish the novel, and I did, and they published it. And it vanished almost instantly, and I hope it stays there.
It's probably not as bad as you think.
I hope it's not as bad as I recall. I haven't dared look at it for 20 or 30 years.
I doubt, as a young man, in doing your first book, you could have conceivably attempted a book like The Fool's Progress then.
That's right. Sometimes when people ask me how long it takes to write a book, I say a lifetime, or as long as you have lived. In this case, that book, Fool's Progress, is based on about 61 and a half years of living.
Right. But you went on to write other novels, including the one, I think, what was called, the one with Kirk Douglas. They changed the name for the movie, and I can't remember.
Yeah, the novel was called The Brave Cowboy. Hollywood renamed it Lonely or the Brave for some peculiar reason. I objected, but had no power to stop it. But they made a pretty good movie of it.
Yeah, that was a good movie. You became more and more interested in environmental issues. Tell me about that concern.
That developed gradually, I think, over the many years that I've lived in the Southwest, when I first went there, I assumed naively that the country was so beautiful and it would simply remain that way. But then gradually I realized that the industrial development was taking place and destroying a lot of places that I had learned to love. And that forced me to become a defender of the land, of the country, of the Southwest and the American West. And that led step by step into a larger point of view, a concern with the assault on life and the land that's taking place all over the world.
How do you defend it?
How do you defend it? Well, I've tried to do it through propaganda, through the written word. Much of my writing, as you may know, is for the sake of environmentalism, part of it. And I've also wandered around the country, mainly in the West, and given speeches and taken part in a few demonstrations and engaged in a few illegal activities here and there.
Oh, I think I read about some of that. That was the...
what we call monkey wrenching. Yeah.
Monkey wrenching. Yeah. The pouring of, what, sugar in the gas tanks?
Sand is better.
Sand is better. Yeah. I'll have to remember that. Is it doing any good?
Well, resistance slows down the process, but certainly we have not been able to stop it. The West is still being chewed up, ground up, gradually transformed from a more or less unspoiled wilderness to a semi-industrialized landscape. Population keeps growing, industry keeps expanding, and the land, the air, the wildlife suffer. They lose.
Of course, your hero, Henry, hasn't helped it very much. I mean, there are pictures of Henry in his pickup, popping beers and flipping the cans out the window. And he's supposed
Quite
to be...
Quite so, yeah.
That's true, and here's a man who, you have a beautiful section of the book where he is a ranger, and he and his wife go deep into the wilderness. Why would he do that? That's almost a contradiction.
Oh, you mean tossing beer cans along the highway?
Sure.
Oh, that's, I was just trying to make a kind of joking point of that, that people get unduly concerned over trivial things like that, like tossing beer cans in a ditch along a highway, while remaining unaware of the really, truly vast destruction that is taking place, whole forests being clear-cut, whole hillsides and mountainsides being strip-mined, and the rangelands of the West being overgrazed by the cattle industry. Beer cans along the highway is a trivial matter, and that was my point.
Yeah, but it can be viewed as a metaphor for the greater destruction, because if somebody is as careless with his garbage and dumping of debris along the highway or along the creek, then why should he care about the bigger elements of the West and the greater destruction, such as damming and this sort of thing?
Beer cans are much more beautiful than highways, in my view. It's the highways that are ugly, not the beer cans. Dump them in a ditch. Let some kid come along with a sack and pick them up and recycle them. It's exactly the sort of thing I refuse to get excited about. When the whole West and the whole planet is being destroyed by overpopulation and over-industrialization, I think it's foolish, silly, to get excited about things like beer cans along the highway. That's exactly the sort of diversion or distraction from true and proper concerns that waste so much time of environmentalists. Whole forests are being clear-cut in the American West. Everything cut down. In Alaska. Not to mention many other places in the world.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, in The Fool's Progress, you show that strip mining has destroyed a good portion of the family farm and left it ugly and polluted.
A part of it, yeah. I think that what is destroying our country, our land, our culture, our civilization, is this lunatic ideology of perpetual growth, growth with a capital G, and simple financial monetary greed, greed with a capital G. Greed and growth, That's what's destroying our country, our culture, our civilization. And that includes population growth. As long as the human race keeps increasing, why, we're not going to be able to save or salvage anything. That, too, is a form of greed, I think. The human greed to dominate the entire planet to the exclusion of all other forms of life.
You now live in Arizona, suburb of Tucson, isn't it?
Yeah. It used to be a village about 30 miles out of Tucson, but now it's a suburb of Tucson.
Tell me how
so you... If I sound a little annoyed about something, that's a good example of why.
That it used to be a village.
Yeah. It used to be a lot of beautiful, open, unspoiled desert around Tucson, and it's gradually being scraped clear by bulldozers for the purpose of putting up acres and acres and miles of instant slums, as I call them, tract housing, all for the sake of profit. But that's not what this book is about. This book is supposed to be a comedy. It even has a happy ending.
Well, there's a lot about the landscape in the book. It is a novel about people and people's relationships with each other.
I think it's a novel about love. The love of men and women. The love of families and family life. And the love of humans for the land that supports them. At any rate, I tried to get those basic themes into the story.
You're an oracle. Is that the name of the town?
Yes. That's where I get my mail.
Tell me about your life there. What's it like?
Oh, I live a pretty routine, lower middle class life. I have two little children, which keeps my wife busy all the time and me busy part of the time. When I'm doing a book, I have to put in at least 5 or 6 hours of work every day, which I do. 5 or 6 hours is usually about all I'm capable of. It does require great concentration to write, especially to write fiction. And after 5 or 6 hours, I may be mentally and emotionally very tired.
Here's a rather long book, but before it started, they were just blanks. You had a blank sheet of paper, and somehow you filled it with words and made the words sing.
Terrifying blankness at page one, yes.
When you planned The Fool's Progress, you knew what you wanted to write about. You knew you wanted to
write. I had a general idea, yeah.
Did you sit down there with index cards or a detailed outline?
No, nothing. Nothing like that. I had the whole scheme outlined on just 3 or 4 pages. The story of a man's life, story of an American farm family. And I just started scribbling. The whole first draft was written in longhand. I filled about 10 or 11 blank notebooks.
Longhand?
Yeah, that way I can write, work anywhere I go. Then I did the second draft on a typewriter. The serious typing began about 3 years ago. Maybe 4 years ago, I forget.
God, longhand takes so long.
Well, you think so? Not the way I work. Longhand is also a kind of shorthand. I find it liberating to work that way, or rather a little too inhibiting to start with a typewriter. Writing in longhand, I scribble along and put down anything that occurs to me that may be remotely useful in a story or essay. And then, of course, when I do the second draft, maybe half of that will be thrown away.
You have had the same editor for quite a few years. Does he work directly with you with regard to the book, or do you turn in pretty much a finished manuscript?
He tries to help. My editor and I have a working agreement. He tries to tell me how to write my books, and I try to tell him how to publish my books. And that creates a very interesting tension. But eventually, we thrash things out. Yeah.
It must work. You've been together for quite a while, haven't you?
I first met Jack McCrae back in 68. Yeah. Yeah. Fortunately, it's not a marriage, but it's a working relationship, yeah.
You have neighbors and so forth. What do they think about this strange guy with the beard who writes these books about the West?
Oh, there are a lot of strange people out there. We're all strange out there, like you are in New York.
So nobody's strange.
My favorite
in New York.
Entertainment in New York City is walking the streets and looking at all the strange inhabitants of this great human zoo. Yeah. And Oracle, Arizona is just a another human zoo, much smaller scale. I'm pretty strange, but all my neighbors are odd, too. And that's what I like about him.
Well, Edward Abbey, The Fool's Progress is just a terrific book, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. I hope the book does well, and I thank you very much for taking the time out to come in and talk to me.
Thanks for the invitation.